All right, well, I've met all of you actually personally. I love that you're here. Thank you. I am Susie Gronsky. I'm a board certified pelvic rehab therapist and a doctor of physical therapy. I've been doing pelvic health for, it's going on 6 years now, and I've been a PT for since 2010. So pelvic health has been something that has been really passionate for me, both for my own story. I have had pelvic pain in the past and your UTIs that are chronic and incontinence when I was younger as well. So it's like, all right, this is coming to my life for a reason, and I'm going to kind of go with it. And I fell in love with it ever since. So right now, my focus is on persistent pain or chronic pain. I hate using chronic because it's like forever, or like a death sentence almost. So persistent, it's annoying, it's there, but there's potential to go away. And that's what today's talk is about, is how to tame your pelvic pain, that beast. So, what is pelvic pain, right? I don't know if many of you know what that is or what this part of your body really is. And so the first part of this conversation is going to be, what is it? What are some symptoms that you can feel? And what does it look like? Like, what is this part of our body? What is it made of? How does it function? The more you understand about your body, the less pain you will have, because you feel more control. You are understanding and getting knowledge about how your body is working and how you can change things once you are aware of them. So pelvic pain is common, which most people don't realize, because when they have pain down here, it is very, very scary. It's not like an ankle sprain, it's not like a hamstring pull or a pulled muscle in your back, it is your genitals. And when that happens, you are like on high alert, hypervigilant, and scared, and oftentimes feeling alone and vulnerable to not even talk about these issues because you think you're the only one going through it when you're not. It is very common. It's common as the common cold, it's common as asthma, women and in men, very common. I believe the literature will give you some statistics. They are highly underreported. You know, a lot of people are not talking to their doctors about their sexual health, or the doctors are not asking the questions about sexual health or issues happening down below. So there's a discrepancy there, but there are some significant statistics that will even say that it is common and it is happening more often than we think. So what does it look like? So for women, the most common symptoms that I hear in the clinic are painful intercourse, burning or pain at the vulva, or the vaginal tissue, right? Painful urination, difficulty urinating, tailbone pain, sitting is problematic, a deep ache in the rectum. For men, very similar as well. Deep ache in the rectum, pain with ejaculation, pain with erections or afterwards, dysuria, painful urination, or pain after urination that doesn't go away. You can even feel bladder pain in both men and women. So sometimes symptoms that present themselves as bladder pain syndrome or interstitial cystitis. I don't know if you've ever heard that, but it's just inflammation of the bladder, which we're now realizing that it's actually pelvic floor related. And if you have those symptoms of urgency and frequency, difficulty urinating, or feeling this sense of fullness around the bladder, pelvic floor, we have to really look at it, because there are some tender points or connective tissue or fascial connections, musculoskeletal, that can refer to the bladder. And you'll learn about that as we talk about the anatomy. It'll make sense of how all these things are connected. Make sure I talked about what I wanted to talk about. Pain in the testicle with men, again, I don't think I mentioned that. Pain with sitting, pain with biking, that sort of thing. Issues that might disguise themselves as pelvic pain or pelvic dysfunction are deep hip, unresolved ortho. You went to every orthopedic person, you've seen PT, but the hip pain is still there. You'll learn that your hip muscles are intimately connected to your pelvic floor muscles and your abdominal muscles. So we can access those muscles both internally and externally if you know what you're doing and how to find them. So hip pain, groin pain, that refers to the groin, deep gluteal pain, again, the connection to the pelvic floor is there. Low back pain, and low back pain. So low back pain and pelvic floor dysfunction, or pelvic pain and low back pain, they go together like peanut butter and jelly. They're neighbors. There's going to be some crosstalk, because that's how the nervous system likes to work. It'll kind of just network with all its neighbors and friends. So it might start off as one thing, but then it could proliferate to other parts of your body as well. And that is common in a persistent symptom that lingers. You with me still? Okay. Okay, if you have questions, you can always, this is a conversation. Okay, cool. Pelvic floor anatomy. Okay, preference, female or male first? Okay, all right. I'll start off by saying that we are more similar than we would think. Men have genitals that are external, females, their genitals are smaller and more internal, like their muscles. But they all function in the same way, it just looks different. Okay, so you have your skeleton, the part that you're sitting on right now are called the sits bones. That's the bony parts of the butt that you sit on. The front of you is your pubic bone. Put your hands on your hips. That's your pelvic, that's your iliac crest. You have the spine, lumbar spine, sacrum, all on the back with its accompanying muscles, hip flexors, lumbar stabilizers. They're all kind of coming in through here. And then your abdominal muscles are covering the front, but they're also sharing fibers and connective tissue with, dun-dun-dun, pelvic floor. Everything in between your thighs is the perineum. We call this the part of the pelvic floor. Everything in red that you see are muscles. So you have muscles that attach from your sits bones to your pubic bone, coming across, attaching to your sits bones, coming across and attaching here. Now this is a tendinous junction, so all of these superficial muscles are attaching to the middle, the area between the vaginal opening and the anus. So women have three holes, the urethra, the vaginal opening, and the anus. Men only have two. But again, these muscles function in a very similar way. They aid in sexual appreciation, they aid in sphincteric control, support, stability, and sump pump. It's a lot of vascular flow going down through here, a lot of blood flow, lymphatic. So you want to make sure that you're having orgasms that are pleasurable because that helps facilitate elimination of toxins, also releases endorphins and feel-good hormones. And some studies are saying in women it helps improve their memory, but that's mostly because of the neurochemical processes that are happening when you're having an orgasm. So there's three layers to these muscles. The first two are very superficial. When we're looking at this from a model or 3D point of view, it's the outside to in. So this is a bowl, and you're looking at it from the outside in. The first two, again, are superficial in what you're seeing here. The last layer is deep, and it's inside the pelvic bowl. This is the bottom of you, essentially. Otherwise, poop and pee would be on the floor. So these guys work all day, every day to help stabilize your movements, but also to keep you continent. So they sling from the pubic bone all the way to the tailbone. Now what this model doesn't show you is how they wrap around the organs. So your rectum has pelvic floor muscles wrapping around it. Around the uterus, the vaginal walls. I mean, all of them are really connected in this bowl. So your organs are sitting nicely in there. Now what's communicating on top are everything in your belly. So your small intestine, your colon is actually coming down through the pelvic bowl. So issues like constipation, for example, straining, hemorrhoids, IBS type symptoms, even Crohn's. We're really curious to see what's happening here because they are controlling peristalsis. This is part of the digestive system. And so if you're having tension or guarding due to pain, or you've been constipated since a kid and these muscles are overly tense and not able to relax, it's certainly going to impact how well the gut is moving in general. And then we'll also make these guys really irritated because they're just tight, overworked, and underpaid, so kind of thing. So that's the pelvic floor. Now the hips, we mentioned the hips and how the hip muscles are all connected. Inside the pelvic bowl, you'll see this muscle right here, this fan-like muscle coming into the inside. This is the obturator internus. That is a hip external rotator. It is actually, the origin is inside the pelvic bowl, comes out of the pelvis and attaches to the femur. Okay, so all of the hip rotators are actually coming from here, going this way and attaching to your hip bone. So a lot of symptoms that can unresolve from the hip with just regular exercise, regular stretching. Most orthopods forget about this part of a body. Like it could be pelvic floor dysfunction that's overfeeding into another part of your body and referring symptoms, if that's making sense. Okay, you also have some sturdy ligaments here, sacroiliac ligaments that help maintain the stability of the pelvic bones, so with the innominates to the sacrum. You also have connections ligamentous and muscular to the anus from the coccyx, so falls on the tailbone, for example. Sitting in a slouched posture for a chronic amount of time, right, depending on someone's profession, for example. So those are just a few examples of how this is connected and how these muscles can ultimately become shortened, okay, and tight, or due to pain eliciting guarding tension, anxiety, and it's kind of like a vicious cycle. So you have your hip connected, so your I didn't mention, but the hip is coming in through here, the hip bone, but it's all ultimately connected. And lastly, you have your adductors, the inner thigh muscles coming in through to attach to the ischiopubic ramus here, this bone. So there's lots of neighbors and friends in this area. The nervous system in itself is really all connected. There's 45 miles worth of nerves in our body. And so from head to toe, it's ultimately connected. And you have a lot of nerves coming out through this area. I'm sure you've all heard of sciatica or piriformis syndrome. Those nerves are exiting through this area and also communicating. And so most oftentimes, it's not true sciatica. It's actually pelvic floor dysfunction that's creating a compensatory movement or guarding pattern in this area, and so it kind of gets everything sensitized. Okay.
You said that it was related to the low back. How do the muscles relate to the low back?
Yeah, so the low back muscles are coming in from the spine, attaching to the ASS. So they're coming from, you know, L4, L5, quadratus lumborum, from the 12th rib. It's all coming down, attaching, coming to the front of the hip so that you can flex your hip or side bend your spine. And then you have your connective tissue and nerves also exiting that as well. And I have netters for more pictures if you needed more visual and stuff. I can certainly pull those up for you. How are we doing? Good? Okay. Is that good? Or okay. So that's the female state. Now the male, again, you'll see very similar, but just more narrow in terms of skeletal structure, and that's because guys don't have babies. Women are made to accommodate a growing uterus and to deliver. So their pelvises are a little wider and more narrower instead of longer, because you don't want to have the baby have to go through a very long tunnel. So for men, it's very similar. Their organs are just different. They have a prostate, we have a uterus. The bladder sits right behind the pubic bone. The prostate is right underneath that. Now, the muscles, again, are very similar in this orientation. Same thing, you have muscles going from the ischial tuberosities, your sitz bones, to the base of the penis. So because your genitals are external. So the base of the penis has muscles around it, and they aid in urine expulsion, ejaculation, and erection. These are the guys that are contracting, and the same thing for women, 8 to 10 times during an orgasm. So they're spasmatically contracting. They also aid in elimination of fluid. The urethra is coming through there as well. The urethra also goes through your prostate. But what attaches to your prostate, what most guys don't know, is that the pelvic floor muscles share fibers with the prostate gland. So it's both a muscular and glandular organ. So when you have pelvic pain, it's very common to have urinary difficulty, pain with urination. If you're having pelvic floor dysfunction or pain in this area, weak urine stream, for example, feeling of incomplete emptying is another complaint that I get. And it's because of these muscles being so overly active or overly heightened, and they're not relaxing when you're supposed to eliminate and evacuate. Okay, so same muscle orientation, anus, they're all connected, and then you also have the same inside bowl orientation from the pubic bone all the way to the tailbone and the hip rotators. You can see this model here will show you how it's exiting and coming out to go to the hip bone. All right. My coccyx. Okay. So how do these muscles function, right? So this will be the next question that I always get asked is like, okay, so they're here, great, but what do they do and how do they work, right? Just like any other muscle, I always give the bicep analogy. You want to pick something up, your bicep has to contract, it shortens. You want to put it down, it has to actively lengthen. If this muscle was not working at the same time that these were working, your triceps would overpower your biceps and you would just drop it. There's an act of controlled active lengthening of these muscles. Then you have like resting. I'm sitting here, my hands are folded. I'm not really using the muscle, but there's still some tone. There's always some tone. Otherwise, it would be like dead weight, right? Same thing with the pelvic floor. You have three positions of the pelvic floor: contracted, elevated. I like to think about it as an elevator. If you can think about going up and down three floors, right? Going to the top floor is elevated and contracted. Going down to the lobby, you're resting, you're waiting. And going down to the basement to get your car or go to parking is an actively lengthened or dropped position of the pelvic floor. Now, when does that happen, the drop position of the pelvic floor? It's when you're pooping and when you're peeing. Those muscles have to relax and open, right? Because they're opening around tubes that need to be emptied. So when people are defecating, sometimes if they have overactive pelvic floor, they reflexively tighten instead of relax. They clench their butt. And so that's also contributing to any digestive issues that might be going on because you're not efficiently eliminating or evacuating your bowels. So that can lead to constipation, hemorrhoids, you name it, bloating, so forth and so on. Now, is that the only contributing factor? No, but it's something that us therapists look at when somebody does have digestive issues and pelvic pain at the same time. They're usually correlated together. So that's the function of the pelvic floor. Now, when does it contract? It contracts when you cough, sneeze, laugh, jump, reach for something, walk. It's always trying to elevate and stabilize you as you're moving your hips, as you're coughing, because that pressure system, your muscles are keeping your organs up, right? The bottom of the bowl needs to be intact. So what do? They contract to close around the sphincters, to keep poop and pee off the floor. So that's the elevated and contracted position. Now, for some people who have pelvic pain, this is what I normally see in the clinic. Their muscles are normally overactive. They're here, and when they try to contract that muscle or let go of that muscle, there's just no give. It's a learned habitual guarding, just like someone holds tension in their shoulders, tension in their jaw. You have people that hold tension in their pelvic floor. And in my clinical experience, I've seen people have jaw and pelvic floor issues together, digestive issues as well. So there's a lot of holding and tension within the abdominal wall and pelvic floor. It's all connected. Okay. So, any questions so far? Good? Okay. All right. So this next section that I'm going to talk about is a little bit about how brain and pain usually work, okay? Because most people are under the impression that there has to be tissue damage or something to happen that's causing me this pain. And men and women who have pelvic pain, they don't have a cast. Most of their scans are negative. Doctors can't find anything. They've tried antibiotic treatment multiple times because they think it's some sort of infection, a UTI or prostatitis or so forth and so on, which is inflammation of the prostate. So they're just treating it haphazardly almost. When they're not finding these things on scans and MRIs and people and doctors don't know what to do, that instills a certain amount of, okay, loss of, I don't know what's going on with my body, I have no control, no one knows, they're not finding something is there. So again, because we're dealing with a very sensitive and intimate part of our body, it is very, very freaky. You know, like, I can deal with, you know, a backache, but what is this going on? Because now you have intimacy, how you present yourself to the world, sometimes shame around our genitals, blame or whatever. You know, lots of things come up when we're dealing with the pelvis. And trauma also is correlated with that, either emotional, sexual trauma, indirect or direct. It's all impacting this part of your body, and then the rest of you, of course. So this is a great question. Have you ever gotten a bruise but didn't know where it came from? Like, you woke up one morning and you're like, where the heck did that come from? It's like a huge welt on the side of your thigh. You're like, what did I do? There's tissue damage, right? It's black, it's blue, it's red, it's painful when you touch it, but you didn't notice it, right? You didn't even know how it got there. So we have to really carefully assess that. Okay, there's tissue damage, but I didn't really feel pain. So can the opposite also happen? Can there be no tissue damage, but someone have pain? And the answer is yes. Most commonly with pelvic pain, there isn't any tissue damage or harm or injury that happened. Maybe it started with maybe a low-grade infection, maybe it started with a low-grade sprain or something associated, and then turned into this full-blown catastrophe of snowball, right? But there's a little more deeper story to that than just the tissue issue. When treating pelvic pain, we need to look at the whole person and their life. It's kind of like when you bake a cake, you don't understand the cake by just looking at the dry flour and the butter, right? You have to look at the cake to understand how it's made and what it is. And the same thing is when you're treating pelvic pain. We have to look at the whole person, and that includes their beliefs, their values, their biology, their relationships, places they've gone, places they haven't gone, what they tell themselves. All of those things are contributing to your experience as an individual of how you're interpreting the pain sensation. And so we'll go, just bear with me, I know this is kind of like a tough pill to swallow sometimes, but I'll go in more into it and unravel where I'm going with this. So pain is a protector, so the biology behind pain, it's meant to protect you. It gets a bad rap though, because what do? We try to avoid pain at all costs, both emotional and physical, right? We don't want it to happen, and when it does happen, we're pushing so hard and fighting for it to go away that we're exhausting ourselves, right? So, but it's meant to protect you. It's the language that your body speaks to tell you something. It's the only way that it can communicate with you is by giving you signals, right? And for some, it's pain. Now, when you have pain that is persistent for, I would say, anything greater than 8 weeks, you know, it's going into months and months, there's a certain rewiring that is happening in your body and in your tissues, in your nervous system, in your brain. I mean, it's all connected neurochemically as well. So, let's say you step on a nail. You see a nail, you step on a nail. Immediately, what happens? Yeah, you're like, you didn't even think twice. You're like pulling your foot out of the nail, and you're like, what happened? Oh my gosh, what's going on? How do you interpret the signal? How does your brain know that you stepped on a nail, right? You stepped on a nail, you get a signal. There are pain detectors. They're just sensors in your body. There's hundreds and hundreds of them that respond to all sorts of different types of things in our environment. Temperature, pressure, touch, itching, stretch, they're all responding and they're all communicating together, both on a electrical basis and also a neurochemical, because they're going to release chemicals at that level based on what's happening, right? So you step on a nail, the signal goes, you're like, the body's saying, oh, we should probably do something about this, but there's no interpretation of what's going on yet until it gets to the spinal cord. Spinal cord says, should we worry about this? Is this something we need to worry about? What do you think? Yeah, we need to worry about this. Okay. Lots of neurochemical exchanges happen. The signal goes from your spinal cord all the way up to the brain, and the brain says, what is it that you need? I'm the CEO, right? Why are you bothering me, right? And they're saying, I think you need to, we've never experienced this. This is something different. You need to pay attention. And only then does the brain attend to what's happening at that tissue level. So at that level, again, this is happening in a split second, right? Like, you're not thinking twice about it. You're not having to go through the process. You have a reflex withdrawal. You immediately get down. You immediately pull your foot away and get help, right? But what happens when the scenario, when the brain literally says, you don't worry about this now. There's bigger fish to fry, right? So here's the scenario. You're crossing the street, it's quiet. You sprain your ankle, does it hurt? Yeah, it hurts, right? You're like, dang, I sprained my ankle. All right, what happens in this scenario? You're crossing a busy street, Chicago, downtown, New York, you know, pedestrians do not have the right of way. You sprain your ankle. Do you even notice your ankle?
You keep going.
Yeah, you're out of there until you're safe. And then the brain will switch the attention to focus on your foot, because the immediate threat is gone, okay? So that's very powerful, right? Again, tissue damage, something happened, but the brain dumped its drug cabinet, because it has its own drug cabinet with opioids and endorphins that are released into the bloodstream immediately to help with starting the inflammation process, because inflammation is healing, right? So it's doing all these things in a split second at a time, but its ability to pretty much open the faucet and completely eliminate your pain in that moment of time, and even maybe longer until you're at safety. And we've heard these like wonderful stories of people miraculously getting out of crazy situations where they're super injured and they still made it out, and they have no recollection of that they were even injured. You know, they're just, I've got a mission, survival, right? The stress response. So that's from a technical way of how pain and the brain and how it's all manifested. Now, pain is in itself both a sensory and emotional experience. It is both. Two, either a perceived threat or an actual threat. So it could be something that someone is telling you, something you've experienced in the past and it's coming up for you, that triggers the same stimulus as if there was a direct threat. So with pelvic pain, I do notice this with a lot of my patients, is that they have multiple triggers. There are triggers that going to the doctor, getting a bunch of scans. I mean, it's like, it's traumatizing in a way, because they're sticking tubes here and there and they're not finding anything. So you're worried, and that's creating another bubble, right? Strengthening the signal a little bit more. Not knowing what to do, strengthening the signal a little bit more. Stopping what you love doing, strengthening it completely more. So you become hypervigilant, very protective, and the nervous system becomes overly sensitive. And when the nervous system becomes overly sensitive, it's like your alarm going off when you burn a bag of popcorn in your apartment. You know the apartment's not burning down, but the thing is blaring like the whole house is burning, right? But you know you're safe. It's the same thing with your body. It has an alert system. It's a protector. It's meant to be sensitive. It's great when it's sensitive, when it needs to be sensitive, but when it learns to be sensitive due to something that's persistent, now that is when we get in trouble. Because now the body is, anything that you do, any movement, because again, these sensors are sensing this, is going to highlight the brain and say, you need to pay attention, this is danger. And again, if it was just an old hamstring sprain or an ankle sprain, it wouldn't be such a big deal to us, but because our pelvises and our genitals have some bigger value to our existence a little bit, it's a big deal. And so it can be very, very strong at that point. Are you still with me? Okay. All right. So we talked about that. This is a great strat. Like, what is, this is a statistic from, there's lots of neuroscientists and pain human scientists that are my mentors that I love, and they're from the UK and Australia, and they're doing all this research on pain in general, chronic pain, persistent pain. And their stats are at one in every four people will experience pain without tissue injury or harm at all. So again, that nothing has happened to their body, but they're physically feeling these symptoms. And so where is it coming from, and why does it persist, you know? Or if it was a tissue injury or a sprain, tissues heal in 6 to 12 weeks. Why is it still there? And again, things that I just talked about earlier was, you know, what people have told you about this, what you tell yourself, anxiety, worries around this, modifications, not moving, fear of moving, intimacy, being afraid to do that, feeling alone, not having support, financial worry, you know, family stressors, so forth and so on. They just build. And at that point, your body isn't as resilient to oppose all of that. And it's giving you a signal. So I would call those more of a negative association, right? You're learning pain, but it's more in a bad way. It's like, this is harmful, I need to avoid that. Oh, I can't bend forward. You know, a lot of people with low back pain will be like, oh, people told me never to bend forward. It's like, well, that's irrational almost, you know? Like, you bending your spine when you're putting your shoes on, but you're sitting, you know, you're bringing your knees to your chest. That's flexing your spine as well. And to tell someone not to do what they love to do is robbing them of being who they are and bringing pleasure into their life, which only adds to the issue. You know, I can't do this anymore. I'm not myself. This isn't normal. It's almost like robbing them of what they love to do, essentially. So that's negative association, and those messages get stronger and they're learned. Your brain is plastic, and I'm sure you're kind of picking up on that. It's very plastic. They call it neuroplasticity, and you see this in patients who have suffered strokes. Right? They tell them, we can get as much as we can back if we just start working and working that arm and training that arm in different ways and so forth and so on. But the sooner you do that, the better your outcome, right? So the same thing with a negative association or a negative adaptation. It's your nervous system and your body's way of relearning pain, but in a more detrimental way to you, that's limiting your quality of life, essentially. And it's not necessary, it's an over-exaggeration of it, but it's very persistent. I talked about the burp popcorn. Any questions so far? This would be, no? Okay. Okay. This question I get a lot asked, is it all in my head then? You know, you're telling me that it's the brain and all this tissue mumbo jumbo, is this all in my head? Well, your brain is your, it's an organ and it's part of you, so technically yes, but, I'm being a smartass, technically yes, but no. And that's going back to it's being a learned phenomenon. What you are feeling is very real. It's oftentimes almost invisible, and again, people do not find things on scans when they're having pelvic pain, but it is very real, and it's subjective. It's subjective. Your experience isn't going to be the same as your experience or your experience, and the way you describe how you feel is very unique and different. Some people use metaphors, some people use songs, some people have certain visuals or graphics in their head about what's going on in their body that can be very scary, you know, that can be very scary, or someone has told them something. Oh, your muscles are kinked, or they, you know, they're just spasming. Even that word, spasming. You know, like, what does that mean? Spasming. Why is it spasming? You know, and there's that lack of education that really gets people very fearful. Just like you have negative adaptation, you can have and learn positive adaptation. So this is where we're getting into. Okay, how do you manage this beast? I love saying the story about the Kung Fu fighter. So we all know they go through great lengths to become master Kung Fu fighters, right? Let's say the Kung Fu fighter is approached by his master and says, you need to kick better. Rub your shins with glass. That doesn't sound very pleasant, does it? No. Shins are pretty sensitive. So he's like, all right, I want to be a better fighter, and I'm going to do this. Takes the glass, rubs his shins every day. Every day, it's painful at first, but still does it. Rubbing, 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 because why? Because there's a reason for it. It's a positive correlation. If I do this, I'm gonna be a better fighter. And so the implication of how we perceive it and what we're doing with it is going to make a very different experience for us. We think it's that Kung Fu fighter thinks it's a good thing to do that. So the pain eventually, it's still sending signals up to the spinal cord, but eventually it'll be muted because this is something that the body doesn't have to worry about. Oh, he's been doing this for a long time. There's no harm in this. We're good. So the signal actually stops at the spinal cord. It doesn't go up to the brain. And eventually, the guy doesn't even feel any pain on his shins when he's kicking, you know, kicking the boards or kicking someone, right? So it's a phenomenon. It's actually quite fascinating, but it's to provide hope for people that if your body has learned a certain way of doing things, you can also unlearn it and retrain it in a completely different way. But it takes some time, and this is where I'll get into my top three tips of how to help pelvic pain and how to subside it, but we'll get to that. I didn't mention, but probably you're getting, pain is produced 100% in the brain, just like from all the examples we've given. Like, unless the brain is actively sending signals down to the rest of your nervous system to say, yes, you need to pay attention to it, there is no sensation, right? Again, someone who is comatose or vegetized, you know, there's nothing. No movement, no touch, no sensation, right? So how do we relate this to pelvic pain, which you probably have guessed already? It is very similar. When I go through my client or my patient's story, I want to hear their story. It's what's going on in your life, what are some mediators and perpetuators that are keeping you in this cycle, and looking at all tokens of their life, you know, relationships, like you were talking about earlier, Allison, like what's going on, what are you doing for fun, what do you not do, what have you stopped doing, you know, how do you feel about yourself, what are you telling yourself on a daily basis, is it your job, you know, are you struggling with your boss, you know, those can ultimately be dangers. And dangers elicit triggers, and the brain will elicit a response. And when we have sensitivity already in our body, like pain, it only makes it more sensitized and like on heightened alert, okay? And I talked about this extensively too earlier, that because we're dealing with our body parts, we're overly focused on it, you know, our genitals, we're overly focused on it. Things that normally do change or are normal, but we never pay attention until something is wrong. And we're overly, like, inappropriate attention to that part of our body, saying, like, it's changing, things are noticing, like, there's soft tissue changes that happen all the time, but because it is part of our sexual anatomy, there's a lot more value to it, and so there's a lot more fear around it as well, which will only trigger that same cascade of the stress response, which will heighten the nervous system, fine-tune it even more, and send signals because it's thinking you're in danger when you're actually not. If that's making sense. And then what happens to your tissues when you feel like you're in danger? Like, what happens to your muscles? They naturally want to contract, right? They naturally guard. Your posture changes. You move less in the pelvis. No hula hooping or salsa dancing, you know? Isolation, you know, anxiety and depression are very common with pelvic pain. And it can be very detrimental, you know? Okay. So, my top three tips to help you with pelvic pain. The first one is self-care. So taking ownership of what's happening and really listening to your body and saying, okay, what does my body need to heal? What prescription do I need to write myself in order to navigate through this? The more we resist something, the more it persists. The more we resist, it persists. So the more we fight, we're only creating that internal dialogue to become stronger and stronger, and your whole body tenses. You know, you can always think back to a time when somebody really ticked you off. You're not very open and like smiley, are you? You're very tense, your heart rate changes, your breathing changes, your muscles get really tense, and it takes some time to even calm down. If you have that ability to do that, even some people have chronic daily stressors. We all do. We all have daily chronic stressors. It's how we react to them on a daily basis and how we're balancing our lives. You know, are we always on the go, or are we relaxing and balancing? Are we down-regulating instead of up-regulating? Are we working in and not so much working out? You know, that sort of thing. Develop a web of support, and that goes with self-care. Pelvic pain can be a very lonely journey if you don't have your support systems in place. It could be your parrot, your bullfrog, your dog, your cat, whatever, you know, family, friends, wellness providers that listen to you and understand and acknowledge that you're going through this journey and are on the ride with you to help and support you. And that's really important. Mental resilience is going to really dictate how well you can recover from pain. So it's really important. Other tools that if you go see a pelvic floor therapist like myself, I teach hands-on tools, breathing, how to breathe, get back into your body. What does it feel like? What does these muscles feel like? What is it supposed to feel like? And so you're getting that feedback, and then you're applying all these techniques when you go home, so making yourself independent. Wow, I got tools in my toolbox now that I can actually take care of this myself. So it's empowering you, it's freeing you, and it's making you feel more in control of your body and what's going on, so that your body can ultimately, in your mind, can actually rest and not stress out so much. So it's huge. Education, learning about your body, taking the steps that you need to do to implement some of these self-care activities throughout your day, consistent and persistent. It's like a broad flowing river, like the French Broad River, you know, broad flowing river that's always going and moving in the direction forward, right? Versus a downpour. You have a waterfall and then it trickles, dries, no rain, and it dries to nothing, right? So results and changes that are plastic and you're working with the nervous system in the body takes time, patience, love, compassion, acceptance. Okay, and you're always going to be making changes in the right direction. We're always changing. Your body, your cells, your skin cells, you have dry skin cells that slough off, new ones are there. You know, you don't lose your skin, do you? It's always there. It's the same thing with the rest of your body and the pelvic floor, you know, and pain here. Things will change. It'll happen. So that is that. Oh. When you go back to doing activities, so self-care, right? You're doing things, you want to start exercising again or being intimate with your partner and exploring different things, right? Because we're dealing with pelvic pain. It can be very scary for women and men. It's how do we explore it in a dosing? So like just like prescriptions have doses, it's how are you dosing your activity levels? What you want to do is you want to push to it, but not through it. Okay? Push to it, to your barrier, to your threshold, but not through it. You don't want to have a screaming body saying, you did too much, and then freak out, right? Those are temper tantrums, flare-ups. They're normal, okay? They're completely normal, and they go away, but we don't want it to learn that pattern either. We don't want to feel great, we push ourselves, and then we get a temper tantrum, and we flare up. So then when we flare up, we freak out, right? We do a lot less, we do nothing, and then we're at it again because then we feel better. So it's like a roller coaster. You don't want to do that. The flare-ups will, I mean, it's inevitable. Sometimes you'll have them depending on the day. You know, we're human. It only happens. But ultimately, we want consistency and dosing to do things in the positive direction, nudge it a little bit, but then back off. And over time, you're going to build your tolerance and eventually have no symptoms and be able to do the activities you wanted to do in the first place. But with sexual intimacy, it's usually involved with, you know, whatever partner. Communication is very important. I often refer to a sexologist or a sex therapist if there's significant amounts of issues going on, because intimacy is a very mind-oriented, and the brain is responsible for orgasm and feeling and so forth. So you want to feel safe and you want to have communication. So dosing in that regards, it takes a little bit of a team as well. My second tip is finding out what your triggers are. And you heard me talk about this earlier, is what is a trigger? What is it? It's when there's an imbalance of danger versus safety, okay? Danger in your body doesn't just mean from an earthquake or, from a waterfall or flood. It's anything that triggers a sense of anxiety or fear or in the past. And again, some of these things are really subconscious too, based on your experiences as a child, even in utero, I believe, how you were raised, your beliefs, all of that is coming into play when we are determining what is a safety and what is a danger. So take a piece of paper, or you can use an app that I like to recommend to my patients called Protectometer. And it's by the same guys that are doing wonderful, wonderful research about pain and humans. But it's great. They're post-it notes, and you get to pick every day, like, what is the danger? And it's things I tell myself, what people tell me, right? I'll never get rid of this pain. It's my fault because I did something too much. Oh, I shouldn't have rode that bike, right? Like, what are you telling yourself on a daily basis that consistently is sending the signal to become more hypervigilant and tense? And so you're in this vicious cycle, right? It could even be a sound, a place of interest, right? You walk into a building and you're like, ooh. You know, it reminds me of something, right? Or a smell, like Jaeger for me. Mm-hmm. It used to be good. At one point it was delicious, and now I can't even tolerate it. You know, it's funny how things change. It was once pleasant for us and brought us happiness, and now we're like, I'm gonna vomit. So you get nauseous, but it's not there. It's just a smell, and I'm not drinking it, but it's bringing up that same visceral reaction. It's fascinating. So reflect on triggers. Who are the people that make you tick, you know? Who makes you happy too? You wanna know that. So dangers and safeties. What is a safety, right? Journaling for some people can be a safety. Being out in nature, right? Spending time with their dog. Telling themselves an affirmation every morning or something. I mean, it's you only know your life, and you can do it. No one can do it better than you can either. So always reflect on that. And there's, like I said, this app would be a great kind of thing if you're looking to like figure it out and have a support system. But you can just take a piece of paper and write down stuff, because it can change too on a daily basis. So. And then when you reflect on your triggers and you find out what like kind of causes your pelvis to tense or your abdominal muscles to tense or your pain to worsen, because a lot of my patients will say stress is a trigger, but stress is such a broad umbrella, right? Because stress isn't just, oh, I got a new job or I got fired. It's again, those chronic daily stressors that I try to open up my patients' eyes to, like, okay, really, let's reflect on what's happening in your day and why does your body feel super tense at night and then you have a lot of pain? You know, what's happening? Once you can recognize them throughout your day, like, oh, I walk in, my boss is calling me immediately or text message, and what does your body do? Like, you get a text message from someone, you're like, and then it goes away. Like, that's a trigger, because it's all adding up. throughout the day. When you recognize that, you can implement certain strategies like diaphragmatic breathing, mindfulness-based stress reduction, which has been hugely researched and has been a great, great, great modality to use for pain in general and pelvic pain. I recommend that hands down. But some sort of like grounding mechanism that you recognize it, you're not letting the fire burn the whole forest down, you've stepped on the fire and you burnt it out. Like you totally got it before it became all crazy. You know what I mean? So recognizing it, then you could reduce it, and then eventually you'll eliminate it, or it'll be there, but you won't be reactive to it. It'll be like, that doesn't bother me anymore. I know I can control my body and be relaxed in the situation. And over time, again, it's going to minimize your pain because you're going to feel more safe and in control of your body. And lastly, mindset, which I did talk a lot about earlier as well, but bring out your Chinese finger traps. Woo! Okay. So really get stuck. Here.
Thanks.
Oh, you gotta play. So I want you to get stuck. Have you guys ever like played with this before? Like super, my fingers are just tiny, oh my gosh. But get stuck, you know. Now try to get out of it. This is a good example. So go ahead, try to get, what do you do? Sometimes you have to get into something before you can get out of it. So this tells you a lot about your learning style and how you cope with things, right? If we're, well, I don't know. I mean, I want to resist. And when we're healing with pain, from pelvic pain, most people do want to resist. But oftentimes we really need to ease into it before we can get out of it. So going in and then coming out. Does that make sense? Yeah. You can break it if you want. It's like, yeah, really, there you go. souvenir. So I do that all the time with my patients because it's such a great learning tool. It's like, how are we dealing with this? You know, how are we dealing with everyday stuff? You know, it's not just pelvic pain, but everything, you know? And we work with it. There's no magic cure or fix. There's no magic, you know, fascial blaster. There's no magic pill or shot. People are trying, but it just doesn't help. And if there were, it would help across the board, but it doesn't. So be patient is what I'm trying to say. It takes a village to really, really get out of pelvic pain. Be realistic with yourself, be positive. Know that again, it probably didn't happen overnight. It will not go away overnight either. And be flexible with that, you know, have mental flexibility so that you can feel comfortable and not be disappointed when things aren't going the way it should be. They're going in the way direction. Sometimes you're going to have ebbs and flows. It's not point A to point B and I'm done. It's more like rocky road, you know, like a little, that's how healing is. That's life. It's the journey. But it's how we're coping with them and the tools that we're using to help cope with them that make a difference, you know. You're unique. Oh, I love this. And when people always say, well, this person, so forums could be crazy. And this is my disclaimer about forums and Google MD, right? There's a lot of stuff on the internet that isn't healthy for us and a lot of misinformation. And when you get on these websites, there's a lot of fear-mongering too. People who have been frustrated have been having these symptoms for several years. I mean, anyone in their right mind who goes in there and starts having symptoms is reading all this, it is a fear, and that becomes a danger. So they're thinking, wow, I'm going to have to live with this for the rest of my life. Oh my God, I can't live like this. To the point where it's really, really detrimental to their psyche, you know. So that's my little thing about forums. But you're unique. So when something works for someone, great. You try it, doesn't work for you. It doesn't mean that it's a failure or that you're faulty or that you need to be fixed still, okay? You have a unique set of keys. And my mentor, Carl Monahan, who's in the UK, he told me about this. He goes, you're a unique set of keys. only that will unlock your healing potential. Everyone has their own key, lock and key, you know? So we're all not created equal. We all come from different backgrounds and different cellular makeup. And so we can't expect for one thing to be cookie cutter for everyone. And acceptance, which you guys learned so well from the Chinese finger trap, is, you know, don't resist. The more you resist, the more you fight, the more you pull, it's not going to get you out of it. You're only going to be fatigued, you're only going to feed into the message, and it's going to be harder to get out of it. Again, you have to accept the current situation for what it is and know that it's never going to be permanent, because even this morning was not the same. Everybody is changing moment by moment. And my conclusion is pain is inevitable, both emotional and physical, but suffering is optional. And so that's the big takeaway message from today. And that's all I have. Questions?
So I'm super curious about what can a client, a patient do to be more empowered to speak about this? Or I guess, what have you come across?
Being yourself. So, you know, not sterile, really. My clinic is very warm. It's like, it's my home. It's your home. How are you doing? Again, just opening up the conversation for them to talk. Why are you here to see me? How can I help you? You know, it's like when automatically have the computer up, it like there's a disconnect somewhere there. And so again, you're building a relationship. That person has to trust you, especially when we're dealing with the pelvic floor. It's important to build trust and confidence and a sense of relief for them, because I'll get asked like, sometimes they don't even know what I do or what it's going to entail. So education, right off the bat, before I even put my hands on them. After they tell me their story, great, thank you for sharing. I'm gonna teach you a little bit about the pelvic floor. You know, asking them, would they rather see models or pictures or nothing? Some people just don't even wanna see it because it can trigger something, right, with trauma. So it's just asking them what they're comfortable with, I would suppose, and being just okay as a practitioner to have these conversations that might be uncomfortable at first, you know, and just asking, how is intimacy? How is your bladder? I mean, are you incontinent? Do you have difficulty with urination? How's your sex drives? How's your erections? You know, and so forth and so on. I mean, once we start opening up the conversation, people like to talk. They're just not being asked. Does that answer your question? Yeah.